Beloved, few things in Jacob's life have been easy, and few of them seem to have come about in what might be called the ordinary way. You remember his martial escapades after walking alone for hundreds of miles to Haran. The very first woman he meets becomes the love of his life, Rachel. But then, in a sort of strange contract, he has to work 7 years for her hand, and then her father substitutes her older sister, Leah, on the very wedding night. So Jacob ends up having to work another 7 years. And so after falling into the sin of bigamy, having two wives, he then ends up taking two concubines, so that he has four wives. Not the easy, normal, simple way with Jacob. And not only does he not marry in the normal way, but that's true even when it comes to having children. He has a whopping 12 sons, including one tail ender, Benjamin. Half of them come through a largely loveless marriage. The last two come through a very loving marriage that had been childless for some years. And the other four sons were born to concubines acting on behalf of their mistresses, his two main wives. And of course, this strange, sad story that we looked at last week involves the tears of Leah, the envy of Rachel, and the trade of mandrakes, of all things. With even the very names of the 12 sons serving as a sort of permanent record of marital intrigue and heartache. And so I say, given the strange ways Jacob came by his wives and came by his children, you will not be surprised this morning that Jacob didn't come by his wealth in the usual ways either. What are the normal ways of attaining earthly goods, whether a few or a lot or an awful lot? Well, some of the ordinary ways involve working and saving and making deals and investing and even inheriting. If you say, well, how did Jacob come by his wealth? Well, there's a certain amount of working involved, all right, and a certain amount of dealing, although you can hardly say that word without wincing in his case. But as we will see, not just working and dealing, but some really bizarre antics, not to mention, and that on his part too, some downright skullduggery. And by this stage you might be thinking, well, can't Jacob just marry, just have children, just acquire wealth in the normal way like everybody else? And the answer is no. And part of it is that the Lord is chastising him for his continual waywardness. But then if you widen it out and think of everything else we've seen of Jacob to this point, you will notice that practically everything that we've seen about this patriarch is not in the normal way. He can't even be born in the normal way. It ends up being a wrestling match with his red and hairy twin. The birthright, he gets it by finagling it from his older brother for a bowl of soup with a roll. The blessing was received by Jacob by hoodwinking his blind father through impersonating his hairy outdoorsman of a brother. And even his journey to Haran was occasioned by the desired murder of him by that brother. And it then included a revelatory dream of a ladder upon which angels ascended and descended from God in heaven to Jacob on earth. And you have to say, he wasn't worthy of it. It was all of grace. This brings us to our text this morning, the second half of Genesis 30. And I ought to say right at the beginning that this is a difficult and even confusing passage. I would say personally that in my own reading through the book of Genesis, if someone had said to me, "What's the hardest bit? What's the bit you don't understand?" I'd say it's our text, especially the latter verses of our text. And I've looked at commentaries in these texts over the years, and each time after reading the commentary, said to myself when putting them down, you know, I still don't understand that text. And that's one of the nice things about preaching a series. You can't do that. You really can't just move on. You have to study it. And so I say to you that in your own reading of the scriptures, or with your family and family devotions, because Genesis is a particularly good book for that, you've probably wondered about this passage too. And even when we read it earlier in this passage, you said to yourself, I don't really understand what's happening there. Especially that bit about the rods. What is going on there? That doesn't really sound right. And that's the biggest issue. The peeling of these rods. And then setting them before the female goats and sheep. What's going on? And then this question, how does it fit with scientific ideas? And then for many of us, we're not even really sure what exactly the science really is. We did some of that at school and we're not too au fait with these matters. But yet the Bible must be inerrant. What's happening? And then there's the issue of the connection with this passage that we've read. And Jacob's dream at the start of Genesis 31, in which rams mate with does. Now, obviously, they're related. How are they related? And this is a good example of the difficulty with the commentators, because if you read four commentators, you might well end up with four different views. And throw into this other exegetical issues, because there are a number of questions. And the difficulty is that if you go one way with this option, then that kind of leads you another way with something else. And then how does all this fit with the life of Jacob? So my method needs to be explained at the start of this sermon. There are sermons, the majority of them, when I will explain deliberately and explicitly and say, now here are the positions which different people hold. I believe that this is the right position for these reasons. And then we move on. Well, this morning's sermon, and I'm saying this by way of being up front, is that I'm not going to do that much. And I'm not going to do this because I'm afraid that if I were to do it, because there are so many issues and they heap up and then it gets more and more complicated, that I'm afraid that some of you at least are going to get lost. And that may well, of course, be my fault, not explaining it well. I'm afraid that too many of us would lose the wood for the tree, so we are going to stick in this sermon, by and large, by simply presenting what I think to be the correct exposition. And it's going to be orthodox, don't worry. There may be different views. Maybe you'll come to a different view. Maybe you'll read another book and it has a different view. What I'm presenting is orthodox, and you'll realize that. And there's a certain liberty of exegesis. We can't go into all the details. We're sticking to the main line. And then tonight, we're going to look at the first part of Genesis 31, including Jacob's dream with the mating goats or sheep. Because the end of chapter 30 and the start of chapter 31, they really belong together. They shed light on each other. And together they present the full picture. And so if I didn't do this, I'd leave you kind of hanging after the end of this sermon. You still wouldn't have it. I don't care to do that. We're going to do the two together to get the complete picture. Now after that somewhat convoluted explanation, let's jump in to this issue, the theme, how Jacob came by his wealth. First, we're going to look at the Ovine deal. And ovine means pertaining to sheep. Bovine pertaining to cattle. Feline pertaining to cats. Ovine pertaining to sheep and goats. The ovine deal. Was that how he came to get wealthy? Second, his gross duplicity. Is that how he got wealthy? And third, his underlying theory. And when I speak here, of course, about wealth, I want to say this too at the front, we're not saying that God promises all Christians wealth, but in the Old Testament and with the patriarchs, the wealth was a sign of the spiritual blessings of God for the New Testament people of Christ who are blessed with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places in Christ. How Jacob came by his wealth. Was it one, his ovine deal, two, his gross duplicity, or three, his underlying theory, or, and this isn't the fourth point, something else. Verse 25, the first verse of our text reads, "It came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, Send me away, that I may go unto mine own place and to my own country." The issue of time comes up here because now the second period of 7 years is up. Jacob has fulfilled his obligation. And with the birth, coinciding with this, the birth of the first son of his favorite wife, Rachel, that's another pointer, time to go. And Jacob, of course, desires to return to Canaan because that's the place where he, and his twin, of course, were born. It was in the land of Canaan that Jacob had lived most of his life, all of his life, except the last 14 years. His parents were there. Isaac was definitely still living, and Rebekah, well, we're not sure, maybe she was still living, or maybe Jacob thought that she was still living, but so much was calling him back to the land of Canaan. It was the place where he was going to inherit and his seed in the years to come. And we need also to remind ourselves of the important New Testament interpretation of the significance of the land for the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as given in Hebrews 11. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And they who say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. They desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. So despite the sinful weaknesses of Jacob, and that's going to loom large in this sermon, we need to remember ourselves that Jacob is, for all his faults, a true believer who wants that land and wants it as a picture of the kingdom of heaven. And that was ultimately where his heart was set. So Jacob says to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service that I have done to thee." And here you see the politeness of Jacob to his uncle and father-in-law Laban. Send me away. Give me my wives and children. Let me go. But there are some additional reasons why Jacob had to ask to leave Laban, more than just politeness. And Jacob knew this, and Laban knew it too. Jacob was a stranger in Haran, without much money. Laban was a powerful man in Haran, with grown-up sons and retainers. So Jacob is very much his inferior, because Laban deliberately had boxed him in to disadvantageous deals. 14 years work for two wives with two handmaidens thrown in. That wasn't a great deal for Jacob. And of course he was cheated out of Rachel. And all he was getting was his bed and board. Jacob, in short, was like an indentured servant more than a son-in-law. And that's why he says, more than just politeness, "Send me away, give me my wives and my children, let me go." And so Jacob also reminds Laban of two things. He reminds him of the work that he has done for him. He doesn't say it, but he is implying in a humble way that he has been engaged in good, hard, honest work. And he reminds him of the time, that the stipulated time for this work is not up. But the problem is, and Jacob had foreseen this, that Laban doesn't want Jacob to leave. And this is understood by remembering the chief factor in Laban's character, which we mentioned previously. He was greedy. "I have learned," says Laban, "by experience, that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake." Jacob is his best worker. He's a better worker than his sons. And through Jacob, Laban is making a small fortune. And he doesn't want to lose him. And this explains Laban's politeness to Jacob. "I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes," verse 27. And we need to understand what's going on here, because this is hypocrisy. Brazen hypocrisy. After how shamelessly Laban has treated Jacob, why in all the world should he esteem, should he presume that his son-in-law, in his eyes, he, Laban, would find grace? "If I have found grace," you'd really think that he'd been treating them well. But it's all just posturing. How could he have found grace after cheating and tricking and double-dealing Jacob? So we should bear this in mind too, when he says to him in verse 28, "Appoint me thy wages and I will give it." There was another instance of this, and we've got to interpret it the same way. It's not a matter of generosity. "I want to be really fair to you, so you pick your wages. Whatever you say, I will give you." He is taking advantage of Jacob's modesty and humility, knowing thereby that Jacob is going to ask for a low amount. By the way, when Laban says, "I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake," the Hebrew word means literally, "I have learned by divination that the Lord hath blessed thee for my sake." That is, since you've been here, my wealth has increased amazingly well. And then wondering if it was because of the Lord's blessing upon you, I went to some sort of pagan divination, and that's what it said. Things don't look good for Laban. Jacob then, remembering he's involved in a deal here, before he asks for his wages, he gets out on the table, as it were, a few simple key facts that support his case. Again, he gently reminds Laban of the quality of his work. "Thou knowest how I have served thee." He reminds him how useful Jacob has been to his father-in-law. For your livestock was little before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude. And the Lord hath blessed thee since my coming. Before I came, you were a very small farmer. He's putting it more gently than I'm just doing. And then, after I came, and through my work, you're a really big farmer. And yet, he presents it humbly. He just says, since my coming, you know how I've worked. You know how useful I have been to you. And now you know also, because I'm going to mention it to you, that I've got to provide for my large young family. 11 sons and daughters, 2 wives, 2 concubines. And now, when shall I provide for mine own house also? I've worked hard. I've been of great use to you. I've got to provide for a family. Laban, keen to get to the bottom line, asks again, what will I give you? Whereupon Jacob makes the following proposal. Okay, I will not leave immediately. I will return to shepherding for you. My wages shall be the marked sheep and goats. A little bit of background information here. Typically, at that time and place, sheep were white, like ours. Goats were black, or at least dark. And most were practically all white sheep, or black or dark goats. But of course there were some of the goats, or the sheep, that had spots on them. And there were some which had speckles. If you want a simple way for identifying a speckle, think of a freckle, or think of a small spot. So it has a spot, or a smaller spot, and usually more of them, speckles, or streaks, ring streaks, streaks. So a spot, or a small spot, speckle, or streaks. And Jacob said, my pay is going to consist of the marked sheep and the goats. Not the pure white sheep, not the dark goats, but those sheep or goats who have spots, speckles, or streaks through them. And my portion of the sheep and the goats that are marked in one of these 3 ways will consist of those that I will take that day by going through all the flock, and, secondly, any that are born thereafter that are marked, because Jacob is going to keep on shepherding for a time. Verse 32, Jacob says, I will pass through all thy flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted sheep, that's the idea there, and all the brown among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and of such shall be my hire. And Jacob, in proposing this deal, throws a check into it. Verse 33, so shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come, when it shall come for my hire before thy face. Thus, everyone that's not speckled or spotted among the goats, and brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. So if there's any sheep or goat that's plain white or plain dark that's in my possession that I'm claiming for my own, then you know that I'm a thief. It doesn't belong to me. I only get the speckled ones. And you have recourse if any non-speckled ones are taken by me. And canny Laban immediately and gladly agrees. These terms suit him down to the ground. He's not going to say, well, I think I'm going to push for you're only getting half of those. He knows that these terms really suit him as they are. Laban says, verse 34, behold, I would it might be according to thy word. You see, Laban knows
as Jacob did too,
that the marked sheep and goats were a distinct minority. And Laban likes this deal because, as we're going to see, he has another trick up his sleeve. And so Laban thinks to himself, this is a brilliant deal for me. I'm doing well with this Jacob. He is making me rich like crazy. And I'm going to get a few more years' work out of him. I'm going to keep him. I'm going to have more work. And even after that, I am going to keep most of the goats and sheep. And he goes away, rubbing his hands in glee. This is the first part of the sermon. This deal between Jacob and Laban. This ovine deal. The deal regarding sheep and goats. And the question of the sermon that runs through it is this. Is this how Jacob became wealthy? Well, it hardly looks likely. You don't become wealthy by making bad deals. Because these marked sheep and goats are, as everybody knows, minority. And then things get worse for Jacob, because Laban immediately double crosses him. Because, contrary to the deal, not Jacob, but Laban gets to the flocks first and sifts them. And what did Laban do in sifting them and dividing between the unmarked and the unmarked, and the marked and the unmarked? To whom did he commit the marked goats and sheep? He didn't give them to his son-in-law Jacob. He gave them to his own sons. And where did Laban and his sons put the marked goats and sheep? Not with Jacob, but 3 days' journey away. Verses 35 and 36 says, but he, Laban, removed that day the he-goats that were ring-spaked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, and everyone that had some white in it, because remember the goats were darker, and so white is a mark, and all the brown among the sheep, because the sheep were white, and so brown is a mark, and he gave them into the hands of the sons, and he set 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. And poor Jacob, he's left with the rest of Laban's flocks, and he has to keep them for nothing. And Laban doubtless congratulated himself on his quick thinking. First of all, I negotiated a great deal for me. And I got him, and not me, to set the wages. And in that deal, I was polite and apparently generous in my presentation. So the deal went really well. Couldn't have gone better. And now, I have gotten the marked goats and the marked sheep already. And Jacob is now to work with the unmarked flocks. So I've got his work for nothing. And these unmarked flocks in the years ahead are not likely to bear many marked goats or sheep. So Jacob signed up to a deal in which he gets a pittance, and now through my craft, he's going to get a real pittance. And he's probably going to have to stay on longer because he's getting so little, and then I get more work out of him, and he builds up my flock. And then, because Laban's had such a good day at the office, he concludes that he is also basically kept the bargain as well. Because the conditions of the deal, what did they say? They said that Jacob would today go through all the cattle and pick out the ones. Well, he can. He can go through them. I've taken them all away, but he can go through them and he can pick any marked ones. Maybe I missed one or two. You see? And then, if Jacob tries to do the dirt on me and take some of the unmarked for himself, then he breaks the explicit contract that he himself made, because he, Jacob, said, if there's any unmarked ones with me, you can call me a thief because I've stolen them. It's brilliant. Laban thinks that this is just his quote-unquote, lucky day, and that he's a genius. And you step aside from the story and say to yourself, within the whole framework of the life of Jacob, this is crafty Jacob, and now he's getting a taste of his own medicine. The Lord is chastising him through this. And if Esau had heard what was going on, he would have laughed. Glad to hear. He did the dirt on me, Jacob. I'm glad to see that Laban's fit for him. And that's just brilliant. Rub it up him, because he's just getting what he deserved. He tried somehow to deal like that on me with the birthright and with the blessing. And maybe even if Isaac had heard of this, he would have said, not quite as gloatingly as Esau, who was reprobate and hated by God, but he would have said, perhaps with a wry smile, well, he's sort of getting what he deserved, because he tricked me too by pretending to be my son. Another dodgy, duplicitous bit of dealing. So then the question is, how is Jacob going to respond? Well, he does not try to chase after the flocks of marked sheep and goats to reclaim them. He doesn't do that. Perhaps he had heard that these marked sheep and goats had departed with Laban and his sons too late. And the terms of the agreement was that he could go through them and pick that day. And he thought, well, they've already had so many hours. If I go after them now, time's up anyway. And then as a second consideration, he would have thought, realistically now, even if I did catch them up, there's Laban and his adult sons and his retainers. Things could turn very nasty if I try and take them back and I confront them. I'm going to be grievously outnumbered. They're not going to listen to me. My status here is very low. So what does Jacob do? Well, he engages in some duplicity of his own. And we come to the peeled sticks. You know how this goes, and you've probably done the same thing yourself. You get a stick of a certain tree, and then there's a cover around it, maybe with a penknife, where you can peel it off. And then you can get a certain part that's white underneath the skin, so to speak, of the branch or twig or stick. And then other bits brown, typically. And then he took these peeled sticks and he put them before the watering troughs. So part of the stick's black or brown. Part of it is white. And at the watering troughs is where most of the breeding takes place, the rutting. The animals all come together. And then they're drinking. And then some of the males copulate with the females when they are drinking. And when the female goats or female sheep have their head down and are drinking the water out of the trough, they have the peeled rods or sticks before them, making an impression on their eyes and in their mind, with the result being the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle, which reflected the marks on the sticks, ring-streaked, speckled, and spotted. And then Jacob goes, they're all mine. I've got them back. And there's more to it, because it's not just Laban who pulls the tricks and works things his own way. Jacob's no beginner at this. He's got more guile up his sleeve. So what he does then with the young that are born, the young marked kids and lambs, is he puts them among the unmarked ewes to make an impression of speckledness and spottiness, so that then these unmarked ewes, whenever they come to bear in the future, have got that impression, and then they might have speckled children too. By the way, if you're wondering about my science here, don't wonder about it. It's going to come good in the end. I'm just telling the story for now. And then when the marked kids and lambs grow up and reach a stage where they can have young of their own and they're marked, he then keeps them away from the unmarked Because he doesn't want the marked ones to see the unmarked and then have young, which might turn out unmarked. And so the young then would go to Laban. He plays it canny on both sides. And then there's more to it. In verses 41 and 42, we read, "It came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle," and here cattle means livestock, and livestock in the form of sheep and goats, "it came to pass when the stronger did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before their eyes in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the cattle were feeble," well, then he didn't put the rods in. "So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger were Jacob's." So he gives some goats and some lambs to Laban too. He wants to be a wee bit fair. And he gives him all the weaker ones. So Jacob gets a strong offspring and Laban gets the weak offspring. And you start off with a 100% unmarked. And then as the years go by, the percentage of the mark gets bigger and bigger. And the percentage of the unmarked gets smaller and smaller. By the way, the commentators typically say that this strong animal or weak animal that bears, it's not just looking at them and look, there's a stronger one or there's a weaker one that's going to give birth. It has to do, they reckon, and I'm just mentioning this as I can't judge, it has to do with the time at which they conceive, because they reckon that the ones who conceive in the spring or the ones who conceive in the autumn are normally one stronger than the other. And so it is, verse 43 says, "The man Jacob increased exceedingly and had much cattle," goats and lambs especially, "and maidservants and menservants, and camels and asses," or donkeys. And maybe Jacob, in having so much in the way of sheep and goats, traded some of his flock for camels and donkeys. And now if we can imagine for ourselves what Jacob thought, because Laban had his own reasoning, Jacob could say to himself, and doubtless he did, it's only human after all, and whatever Jacob is, you have to say he's human. Jacob could say, by way of self-justification, "Well, I kept the deal," according to the letter, but not the spirit. "I kept the deal. The deal said nothing about peeled rods." It said nothing about peeled rods. "And all I was doing was using enhanced breeding methods. I didn't break the deal. And besides, if that doesn't cover me," and this is how the human mind works too, "besides, if that doesn't cover me, look what he did to me. What did he do? On day one of the deal, the words were only just out of our mouth, and before I could go through and take out the marked ones, that were speckled and spotted and streaked, he, in his duplicity, got there and took them all away and gave them to his sons 3 days and carted them off 3 days' journey. And what have I been doing for 14 years before this? Breaking my back with hard labor for two wives." I didn't come with much of a dowry there, they're just one maid servant each. "I deserve an awful lot more for my work. And all I'm doing is fighting fire with fire. He did it to me. I'm only standing up for my rights." And in these sort of hodgepodge arguments, 99% of men would say, "That, good enough, you've justified yourself." And the arguments like these of Jacob have been used frequently in the 3,000 plus years since the death of the patriarch, including by some of those who are true believers and Israelites indeed, whose spiritual father is Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And here are some of these awfully impressive arguments for a bit of sneaky duplicity and dirty dealing. Here's the first one. "Everybody else is doing it." What an impressive moral argument. Everybody else is doing it. And isn't the world totally depraved? So you're saying that you can do it because totally depraved people are doing it too. Marvelous. "Everybody else in the sphere of agriculture," so that's the setting here, "in the sphere of finance, in the sphere of sales, in the sphere of sp- sport. They're all doing dodgy practices. And therefore I can do it too. Mighty. And sure, nobody thinks anything of it. And if I don't do it in my workplace, I'll be the loser. So everybody else is doing it. Ergo, it's okay. Here's another classic. Business is business. So the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, is a good commandment, a wonderful commandment. And you mustn't steal when you're in church. You mustn't steal in your family. You mustn't steal in your neighborhood. But in business, on the other hand, the rules are different in business. Stealing is still not brilliant, but it's not really that bad. You can steal in business. Now I'm putting it a bit more bluntly than the way the argument goes, but that is what it boils down to. And then the other commandments. Let's take the ninth and the tenth. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not covet. And those commandments are commandments, and they're wonderful, and they're from God, and they're to be observed with your wife or husband. They're to be observed with your friends. They're to be observed with your children. But unfortunately, there's this section of life from Monday to Friday or Saturday when you're at work, and you can covet at work. In fact, you kind of have to covet at work. And you can tell lies at work, because after all, it's work. You see, business is business. And here's a third classic. Well, I have to provide for my family. God wouldn't want me starve, would he? And the Bible says that if you don't provide for your family, well, you're worse than an infidel. Well, on that argument then, you could perfectly justify taking the mark of the beast and bowing down to the image of the beast. Because I can't buy and sell without worshipping the image of the beast or taking the mark. Therefore, I have to provide for my family. Therefore, you just have, sure, it's only a mark. You're only bound down to a statue. Everything will be okay. With ethics like these, you don't have to keep a single commandment of God that you don't want to. Wonderful. And you understand, beloved, that Christians are called upon to be Christians everywhere, in all spheres, and at all times. And that the world expects and even demands in their conscience and in their judgment of you that you be a Christian in all spheres, everywhere, and at all times. And that when you don't do that, you're going to be nailed for it. Besides now sinning before God, which is the higher and most important thing. The Christian teaching is that it is better to suffer than to sin. That was how Jesus Christ lived. He believed it was better to suffer unrighteously in the cause of the truth, than to sin. And you all know that. But all of us struggle with that at certain times and certain tricky positions, especially if we've already sinned, especially if we're on the back foot. And then you feel, well, I just have to sin, and hopefully it's not that big a sin, and hopefully it won't get me into much trouble. And hopefully God will forget it, and hopefully I'll forget it. But it isn't as easy as all that. And it wasn't as easy as that for Jacob in his life or in his dealings with God. A lot more could be said there, but we need to move on now. Was this duplicitous dealing of Jacob the reason for his wealth? No. There are people who do get wealthy by sinning. There's no doubt about it. That is how they got their money. But it's not that way with Jacob. What Jacob is doing here is, he knows, because God has promised, that he is going to become wealthy. But he's giving God a helping hand. Because maybe God, who after all only owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, maybe God isn't able to give him enough wealth. And maybe the Lord, who created this world in 6 days and all very good, maybe the Lord needs a bit of assistance. And maybe with my wise deviousness, I can help God because God doesn't know how to do it. Because after all, he's only infinitely wise. And sure, what does he know? And so Jacob runs ahead of God, as he typically does, engineers his own circumstances to get what he wants. And you've heard this before concerning Jacob. It's his old problem. He wants the birthright for the right reasons. But in Genesis 25, he takes advantage of his brother and does him out of the birthright by selling him a mess of pottage. In Genesis 27, he wants the blessing. That's good. The blessing is rich salvation in Jesus Christ. And therefore, he pretends to be his brother and dresses up like in the pantomime. And now here, in chapter 30, God has said he's going to be rich. And so he'll give God a helping hand and engage in subterfuge and deception. Which brings us finally to the issue that has popped up in your mind when we read it through this sermon and probably other times when you read this passage on your own. The underlying theory of Jacob. The theory that underlies Jacob's activity with the peeled rods in front of the female goats and cows, goats and sheep, is called the prenatal influence theory. Before birth, and then also called the maternal influence theory. The idea being that if a pregnant animal or woman, especially even at the time of conception, but sometimes often during the period of pregnancy, has in front of her something very striking, and that impresses in that woman or animal's mind, then the young which that female produces may well have that image reflected in their offspring. Some of you may have read the quote on the bulletin, the top right corner, before this sermon. A pregnant mother sees a man with no right arm. She has a baby. The baby has no right arm. Ergo, there must have been an impression made in her, and that came out in her child. And there are various ancients, and even some moderns, Descartes, the philosopher, Aristotle, some Greco-Roman historians, some in the early church, some later in the church, reckoned that this was indeed the case. This prenatal or maternal influence theory. And I imagine there are still some people in the world today who hold that this is the case. And now we need to notice, and I've seen in looking at you some funny faces, and they've made an impression upon me. We need to realize that Genesis 31 teaches that Jacob held this theory and acted upon this theory. But Genesis 31 doesn't teach that this is true, or that God is giving us an insight into what happens in the birthing of children through this influence. The Bible records for us that Jacob held this. Now, we don't have access to the mind of Jacob, but there were probably lots of things in the mind of Jacob that were nonsense. Now, this is one of the things in the mind of Jacob that is nonsense. And this is good news, and you could imagine some women, Christian women too, in earlier ages, being helped by this. Imagine getting that idea into your head. And then you see someone, let's say coming back from the Napoleonic Wars, and a man has been wounded and he's lost both his arms, and you as a woman, or the husband, realize that the wife's staring at this man without any arms, and you're thinking, oh, she shouldn't have looked. She shouldn't have looked. Maybe our child's going to have no arms. That's not the way of it. And now I am accepting the modern scientific theory. I think there's good reason for it. Genetics influence these things. And there are other factors of how things go in the womb, but it's not the impression. And a factor of issues. But the impression on a mother's retina doesn't deal with it. And so this theory, this maternal influence theory, which Jacob held and acted upon, also called the prenatal influence theory, isn't the reason for this wealth at all. The impressions upon these female goats or sheep did not cause speckled, ring-straight, or spotted offspring. Something else did. The grace and mercy of the sovereign God. His covenant blessing to Jacob is found in Genesis 27, verse 28. Therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. God will give you agricultural prosperity. The promises in Genesis 28 too. God will keep you and look after you in all your ways. And then remember, the promises to Jacob, and indeed Isaac, are repetitions of the promises to Abraham, the grandfather of Jacob, when he said, I'm going to make you rich and wealthy. And so the production of offspring, sheep and goats, that were marked in those three ways, came in spite of Jacob's sin, in spite of Jacob's bad science, and not because of it. And you say, I never thought, okay. And this shouldn't be strange to us, because when you go back to Abraham, how did Abraham get rich? In large part, he got rich through in inverted commas, he got rich through his sins. Remember? In Genesis 12, he went down into Egypt and he pretended that Sarah was his sister. Although she actually was his half-sister, but he was telling a lie because his intent was to deceive. And then all sorts of afflictions fell upon Pharaoh, and Pharaoh chased them out and said, look, take all this wealth, and he gave him all these riches. No, get out of here, get out of here. And then in Genesis 20, Abraham is in Philistia, and he tries the same old stunt again. And then Abimelech's house is judged. And Abimelech chases him and gives him more wealth. And Abraham, he gets wealthy because of God's blessing, even though he's sinning. And here Jacob, even though he's sinning, and even though he's practicing awful science, God makes him rich anyway. This is the good news for the people of God. I'm not saying sin. I'm not saying act duplicitly. I'm saying the exact opposite. But the good news for the people of God is that God will bless you and enrich you in spite of your sins. Because if God didn't enrich you, in a sense, spiritually now, in spite of your sin, you wouldn't be any blessing for you whatsoever. You couldn't. But I'm saying now, don't steal, don't lie, don't act duplicitously, but know that God is going to bless his people through all these things. And if you still think I haven't made that point strongly enough, I'll throw in this point, which is mightily enforced in the life of Jacob, that it's going to come through chastisement. Because Jacob has gotten the wealth that God has promised, but he hasn't gotten away with his sin. God is going to have to keep beating him with many stripes, to use the language of chapter 12. And all this shows us, as I've said, the richness of the God of glory. He has sent his Son to die for sinners, wicked people, foolish people, duplicitous people, crafty, sneaky people.
with the goal that having our iniquities imputed to Christ, God will enrich us and bless us with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places, and he'll also chastise us. And we're going to look more at this at the start of Genesis 31 this evening, beloved. Amen. Our Father in heaven, bless to us thy word, give us understanding from the holy scriptures, and take from us, remove from us all deceit and lies, and teach us to go with our conscience and according to the word, and not fear consequences. Grant us this blessed lesson, for we ask in Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.